Hey everyone, it's The Takeaway. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, host of the podcast What Next TBD at Slate, in for Tanzina Vega this month. And I'm coming to you from my closet-turned-radio studio here in Brooklyn. It has been quite a week. Thank you for spending it with us. The total number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 has now reached around 1.5 million globally. The official death toll is rising, and as we'll discuss later on the show, that number doesn't account for the many people dying who were never tested. As the number of cases rises, so do concerns about privacy. Around the world, heightened surveillance measures have emerged, and privacy advocates are sounding the alarm. In China, the government has used everything from facial recognition software to drones to stem the spread of the virus. In Italy, authorities have relied on location data on phones to track how many people are actually following lockdown orders. And here in the U.S., both the federal government and private companies like Google are using or considering using different kinds of tracking and surveillance technologies in the fight against COVID-19. And though those tools may be helpful in monitoring the spread of the virus, they're also renewing debates over how to balance public health and personal privacy. For more on privacy during this pandemic, I'm joined by Natasha Singer, technology reporter at The New York Times covering privacy, and Jen Daskal, professor and faculty director for the Tech Law and Security Program at American University School of Law, and a former national security official in the Department of Justice. I asked Jen about the kind of surveillance technology the U.S. is leveraging as COVID-19 spreads.
So the U.S. is employing a range of efforts using technology that's already in existence. So there have been no new authorities granted, no new collection programs developed. What we're seeing is a range of companies sharing, for the most part, aggregated data that allows the tracking of things like hotspots and also the people's compliance with social distancing orders and where people are congregated. Mm-hmm. This is something that, for example, Google is doing. Facebook has announced that it's going to be making this data available on its platform. And there are, in addition, new efforts by the CDC to gather some of this aggregated, anonymized data currently.
And what's the idea from their point of view about how this would help?
There's kind of two big buckets of collection or use of data, more importantly. There's aggregated, anonymized population level data that, if done properly, can be anonymized and can provide important information about trends, such as where hotspots are, which can help allocate resources more effectively, and also trends, in this case, with respect to how well people are doing with respect to social distancing, which can help determine if other additional measures are needed. There's also the possibility of doing a range of individualized tracking. So there's contact tracing. We've heard a lot about that, where a particular person is identified as sick, and then there are mechanisms to try to go back and figure out that person's past movements and associations to warn other people that they might have been in contact with. There's also the possibility, this is something that's being done in Poland and some other jurisdictions as well, of using data to ensure compliance with quarantine orders. And we're starting to see jurisdictions like the UK and Germany talk about the possibility of giving people certificates if they've tested positive for an antibody. So there would be some sort of identification and then presumably some sort of mechanism to establish that one has developed an antibody, which would then allow for the ability to engage in different kinds of activities than others who did not have the antibody.
Natasha, you've written about how a lot of this has worked in other parts of the world. China, Singapore have also tried surveillance technology in their COVID-19 response. How does some of that work, and how granular is it versus the idea of kind of anonymized data?
So I think you have to see a lot of these surveillance efforts in context with how different countries are actually responding to the virus itself. Because if you're not testing the majority of the population, the surveillance measures are really not going to help you that much. So what we see in China, for example, is that China required everybody to download an app, and it gives you a color score, red, green, or blue. And if you're green, you were allowed to go out. use public facilities like the metro. And if you were red, it meant you had to quarantine yourself and stay home. But nobody explained to people in China how these decisions were made. And if you were told to stay home and, you know, and when you go out, you know, you're being stopped everywhere and required to show whether you're red, green, or yellow, people couldn't object, even if they'd never been exposed to anybody. So this was being kind of enacted upon them. At the same time, though, right, China set up a system where it's testing tens of millions of people and it's taking people's temperature all the time when they want to get into a building, when they want to get into their apartment building. And if they have a high fever, they're not allowed to go home to their families and possibly infect them. So it's really hard to separate the usefulness of the surveillance from what's happening on the ground. If you already have a comprehensive system in place, then perhaps some of the surveillance measures are useful. When you ask about granularity, both Singapore and South Korea instituted a system of contact tracing where they posted information about every single person who tested positive for the coronavirus. In the case of South Korea, they posted, for example, the name of the apartment building you lived in, the name of your employer, when you took the subway, when you changed trains at a specific subway station, whether you wore a mask. And Singapore also included the address of where you worked. And so people were able to figure out, was I there at the same time? Should I quarantine myself? And it enabled the authorities to also find individuals who might have been at certain places at certain times and institute health measures. The problem was, in South Korea, there was also kind of public shaming and threats to people who had been diagnosed because, like, internet trolls were able to identify people.
Jen, you mentioned private companies, but Congress allocated $500 million to the CDC for public health surveillance and data collection. What will that money do on the government side?
So as far as is known at the moment, it appears that the CDC is, again, collecting aggregated level data that appears to be anonymized to do the kinds of trend mapping that we've talked about. That is different than the individualized tracing that we were just talking about a second ago. The CDC has to report back within 30 days, so I think we will learn a lot more about what the CDC is doing. But I think the concern about contact tracing in ways that identify individuals and put them at risk is a really important one. And I think that there are ways and there's some kind of innovative developments that are being pursued by universities and nonprofits to develop technical tools that could be used to do the kind of contact tracing that health officials claim is incredibly beneficial, particularly once and if we get to a point where there's widespread testing that don't involve governmental collection.
Natasha, do we know from any of these attempts in the U.S. whether they've been effective in helping slow the spread of the virus?
Well, I think the efforts in the United States are so new that we don't know. You know, Google just started offering a system where it's looking at people's locations in aggregate and sort of analyzing how much people are moving or how much less they're moving now. Under social distancing. But when we look at other countries, Singapore already has one of those Bluetooth apps. It's called Trace Together. And you download it voluntarily and you turn on the Bluetooth and it collects data on every other device that you come in contact with. And then if you are diagnosed and test positive for the coronavirus, you then can voluntarily send your logs to the government and you won't know who else you came in contact with. Right. So you're not violating, you're not, other people's privacy isn't being violated. People who were then contacted, who came in contact with you, are not told who you are. So it seems like there are ways to do privacy preserving technologies. And I also think we have to think about when it's voluntary and when it's coerced.
Jen, do you worry at all that some of these surveillance measures, particularly I think about the ones in China, for example, could be exploited beyond this pandemic that, you know, could track dissidents, could track Uyghur Muslims, anything like that?
There already was a surveillance state in China. There's long been a surveillance state in China. So I think that was a concern before the coronavirus, and it remains a concern after the coronavirus. But I think if we are applying some of the lessons to the United States, and if and when there is some sort of compelling case that there needs to be new surveillance authorities or new governmentally controlled surveillance systems, we ought to, I think, first of all, demand very clearly what exactly the need is and how the program would serve that need. If that case is made, I think it's essential that any new authorities be coupled with sunsets and clear criteria for determining when the sunset happens so that you don't get in a pattern where there's renewing sunsetting periods that go on into what is effectively perpetuity.
Which reminds me of the post 9/11 sort of surveillance that went into place after the Patriot Act and sort of multiple renewals.
Exactly. And it's also critical to, as we're thinking about this particular set of considerations, to ensure that any data that's collected either by the private sector or by the governmental sector is destroyed, is not retained longer than the purpose for which it's needed, which again requires a very careful tailoring of the program, whether it's private sector organized or governmentally mandated, be very clear. You know, one of the interesting things and differences between the surveillance systems that were put in place after 9/11 and the kinds of things that are being talked about here is that after 9/11, the goal was to track terrorists. And in order to achieve that goal, secrecy was essential, because if you were tracking an alleged terrorist and you tip them off, you've destroyed your intelligence value of what you're doing. Here, by contrast, there is a really important goal of transparency. What the information that is being collected has to be made publicly available and transparent in order to be effective. And so I think that provides some hope that any systems that are being put into place will incorporate that principle as critical for serving the public health goal that they're trying to achieve.
I just think, though, the risk is we develop a system for civilian purposes like facial recognition with driver's license photos, and then we see, you know, security agencies using them to particularly target immigrants. Mm. So I think one of the issues is to make sure data collected for one purpose is not allowed to be used for another purpose. And the UN actually has a program called UN Global Pulse, and they have a set of principles, you know, and one is, as we talked about, like, you must delete the information when you're done. But it also has principles like, you know, you have to figure out narrowly what you're trying to do. You have to collect the least amount of data necessary for their purpose and not use some emergencies and excuse to collect data about everybody.
Natasha Singer is a technology reporter at The New York Times. And Jen Daskal is a professor and faculty director for the Tech, Law, and Security Program at the American University School of Law. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.